Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to This Miraculous Life, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Oliveri Olumba. We are here today with some phenomenal guests and a really interesting letter for you. But as a reminder, this show is all about tuning in with the miraculousness of life and tuning out from all of the bullshit that keeps us disconnected from that. I started this show because I have a belief that life is a profound, insane, phenomenal, unimaginable gift and reality that we all have the privilege of participating in, and that there are a number of things that keep us disconnected from experiencing it that way on a day-to-day basis. So this show is all about getting that stuff out of the way and being able to connect with the profound and awesome nature of life. So every episode we respond to a letter or a question or a life circumstance going on that is keeping someone disconnected from that miraculousness, and talk about how to tune back in. So today I am here with a phenomenal guest. Her name is Huma Sikander, and she actually is a colleague of mine and an amazing psychotherapist and couples therapist. And as always, here with the wonderful Alexia Brown, my studio engineer. And we are talking about a topic today that is very close to my heart, which is interracial relationships. As some of you may know, I am in one. My husband is an African man. He's Nigerian, and he was born in America, and then he moved to Nigeria for his first 10 years of life. And then he came back to the States and went to middle school. Well, I guess the end of elementary school, middle school, and high school in Washington, D.C. And he has been a Washingtonian ever since. And I had the privilege of finding him about 8.5 years ago. So we've received a letter from somebody who is also in an interracial relationship and who is having some questions and some challenges, in particular during this time that we find ourselves in America, which is, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say how I feel about it, which is, unfortunately, we find ourselves in the Trump era. And so this letter deals with that challenge. So welcome, Huma. Thank you for being here.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yay. So why don't I go ahead and share the letter with our listeners and our guests, and then we can dive into what to do about such an important issue during these times. So here we go. This is what our listener writes to me. Dear Sarah, this letter is going to get political. Hold tight. When Donald Trump was elected, for me and many of those closest to me, the sentiment was similar to the feeling post 9/11, only worse because it was from within. An attack on what we believed in. An attack on what we have achieved. An attack on us from our own fellow Americans. Oof. I just want to take a pause and say every time I read that, it brings tears to my eyes. The statistics indicating a rise in hate crimes following the election of Trump show that this was more than just a feeling. Still, I never thought national politics would affect the relationship I have with my boyfriend. until I was invited to his upcoming family reunion. We are a biracial couple. I am African American and he is Caucasian. He was just as devastated as me to see the election of Donald Trump and disgusted with the news of hate and violence that followed. But his family is different. They are Trump supporters. I have met his parents. For the most part, they've been cordial, though the awkward atmosphere has been palatable and there have been moments of tension. On several occasions, I felt his father was trying to get a rise out of me when he asked pointed political questions, like what I thought of President Trump's immigration ban, and didn't I think it was time to do away with affirmative action? Out of respect for my boyfriend's family and household, I declined to engage in this conversation. At the family reunion, I would have to face not only his parents, but his extended family of aunts and uncles, who, from what I understand, are likely to be less refined and more overt in their political opinions. I know that, especially as a person of color, my presence, politics, and relationship status with their nephew, cousin, etc., is likely to make some of his family members uneasy. My boyfriend tried to explain it as some of his family was just quote-unquote old-fashioned. But for me, this is a cop-out. Let's call it what it is. It's racism. I hate Donald Trump. His disparaging remarks towards women, minorities, immigrants, and everything he stands for. By extension, I am finding it difficult not to at least dislike or distrust those who support him. My boyfriend certainly doesn't fall into this category, but his family does. And his family, despite their politics, are an important part of his life and background. I know family is important, but I wish my boyfriend would take a stronger stance against his family's racist undertones and hopefully misguided support for Donald Trump. Am I putting him in an impossible situation by asking him to choose sides? How can I reconcile his lack of a firm and visible rebuke of his Trumpist family members with his love for me, who I am, and my background? I know this is a lot to digest, and there are no easy answers, but I'm sure I'm not the only one struggling with love, family, and politics. Looking forward to your thoughts and insights. Sincerely, Love vs. Politics. Ooh, wow. Oh, it's heavy. Yeah,
absolutely. And it almost takes me back to that time when it happened, when the election had just happened.
Same.
Yeah.
Same. I think this is a really beautifully written letter. I have to say to the person who wrote it, thank you. And that first paragraph about 9/11, man, that makes me cry. And I don't know. I just think it's a really beautiful paragraph about how that election did feel to many minorities.
Right.
And
I think when it says, you know, it was an attack on us.
Right.
I think it sometimes when we think about it, we, you know, I'm just reminded of this experience that I had. I was at Northwestern at that time, and I was moderating a group of processing for post-election and helping students kind of process what had happened and just kind of be able to have a space where they can share their emotions. And a lot of, you know, similar emotions of just hatred for the situation, hatred for people who had voted, and a lot of rage for what had happened. And we processed that and talked through that. And what I noticed was, you know, the students who identified as Caucasian white, feeling really quiet in the room, and And, you know, I was wondering about that. I was wondering about their reactions. And, you know, one of them said, you know, I feel like this is really disturbing for me to see my class fellows and my friends suffering this way.
Right.
And I want to create distance with people back home who have voted for Donald Trump.
Right, like their family members.
Right. Yes. And I, in turn, being related to them, feel this guilt and feel this shame that they did this.
Right.
But then I feel torn because I have relationships with them too.
Right.
And it's just, it feels like it's not just an attack on minorities, but everybody who supports liberal views and equality and social justice.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it was, it came as a shock to a lot of us.
Right.
And I think, but I do think that, as a Caucasian person, it was shocking. It was devastating to me. And what I can say is that, you know, I guess the difference is that maybe sure as a woman, but as a white person, that the attack was on what I believe in, but it wasn't on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so there is a difference.
Absolutely.
There, you know,
it's so, not invalidating of your identity.
Precisely. Right. And it doesn't make this safety. My safety is called less into question.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I don't, the moment that Donald Trump is elected, again, yes, as a woman, but as a white person, I do not become less safe in America, you know, but there are a lot of people who do.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
That's
the unfortunate part of it, is the reactions following that, the hatred, the violence that followed and continues to follow.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And to this day, it makes me angry that there are a lot of white people who would disagree with that statement, even though there's clear evidence to the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to introduce Huma, because she's the perfect person to respond to this letter. And Huma actually did her master's capstone on interracial couples. So she is an expert. And I'm so excited to hear what she has to say for the challenges that the couple who wrote to us is facing. And this couple is an African-American woman and a Caucasian man, just so that everybody listening is clear. And I'm excited for Alexia and I to weigh in as well, because I am a Caucasian woman. I'm in a relationship with a black man, and Alexia is a black woman. Right, Alexia?
That I am.
So I'm so glad that you are here. And can you share with us your racial identity, Huma?
Right. So I'm a South Asian woman, Muslim by religion. I'm married to a Persian man who grew up in the United States, whereas I grew up in Pakistan.
Okay.
And then I lived in Dubai.
So your husband is American.
Yes. He's an American Persian. And he grew up here, moved temporarily back to Pakistan to take care of some family business and family issues. We met while I was living in Dubai, and he was living in Pakistan temporarily. Mm-hmm. So I lived in Dubai for 5 years before moving to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about 7 years ago. And at that time, I guess we had never thought that we would be both living in the States and would gravitate towards each other in a way that we would end up spending the rest of our lives together. But it's happened, and it's wonderful.
I have a question. Do you consider your relationship an interracial relationship?
I consider it an interreligious relationship with the religion part of our identities kind of bringing the difference.
Got it.
So his family is Zoroastrian and my family is Muslim.
Got it.
So
Rostrand.
Yes.
I don't even know what that is. Oh my goodness.
That is exactly the reaction we get from most people when we share that.
I need some education. Yeah.
Right. So I guess our family of origin and our upbringing has very different cultures and very different religious practices. And him having grown up in the States, his family is obviously very different in terms of their outlook and their opinions from my family, who's primarily based in Pakistan.
Right.
So I do consider my relationship sort of in the same realms as interreligious and interracial.
Got it.
Yeah.
Intercultural, at least, I guess. Yeah, absolutely. Well, as somebody who has been studying interracial couples and working with them and conducting couples therapy for, it sounds like, couples who may have found themselves in this very same situation that Love Versus Politics has described to us in her letter. Where would you begin? What stands out to you about this letter, Huma?
So the first thing that really stands out to me in this letter is the sense of loneliness that she feels in grappling with this issue and the responsibility that the writer is putting on herself to reconcile his, you know, not having a firm rebuke of his Trumpist family and his love for her.
Right.
So her words that, how can I reconcile with his, with this behavior that I'm seeing in him? From that statement, what I sense is that she's feeling like the responsibility of this falls on her, that she has to make sense of this. She has to find a way to reconcile this. And the reason why the statement is really important, I feel, is because a lot of times in interracial couples, this one statement of, how do I reconcile this difference that we're noticing, can be so profound and create this experience of alienation from your partner.
Right. She's taking it. She thinks that if it is going to be reconciled, it's going to be by her, not by her and her partner together. Right.
So one of the things that stands out to me as we're talking through this is sort of the parallel that we see in society, where racial minorities feel a lot of sort of this pull to get engaged in, you know, activism against racism and taking on that burden to set the society in a path that feels more loving and more authentic and accepting of everyone.
Right.
And, you know, there's a statement that the ultimate white privilege is to recognize racism but not have to do anything about it.
Amen.
Right. So, just going off of that, and you read this letter and you almost see this dynamic playing out where she is, as the racial minority in the relationship, taking on the responsibility of reconciling this and almost not seeing that she needs to share this responsibility with her partner, who is Caucasian white.
Right. She's almost trying to solve it alone.
Right. So, you know, sometimes in interracial couples, we feel like there's this notion that what happens in society, we're impervious to it because our connection feels so strong, our love is so strong. But the dynamics that are happening in society have these subtle ways of seeping in where we don't even notice them.
Absolutely. So can I ask you a follow-up question? So you notice that she's using I statements as opposed to we statements, and that in many ways that is reflective of some of what is happening with race in society at large, which is that people who are a minority can feel a lot of responsibility, that the burden to navigate the problems that we're having with race falls on them, which is highly problematic and unfair.
And
also not true.
Absolutely,
right?
Like, it's not true.
That it's not only is not right, but it's not possible for black or brown people alone to navigate and change the problems that we have with race in our society, in our relationships. It requires white people to stand up and participate and care and take a stand. So you're noticing that that dynamic has perhaps seeped into this relationship a bit.
Right. And I'll go a step further in that, where not just in terms of the responsibility for creating change, but the responsibility of holding white people accountable for creating change. Minorities often feel like they have to play that role, whereas in most situations, they might not even have the resources or the stability or the safety to really hold a white person accountable for their not taking action.
Which certainly applies in this situation, because of course the her partner is going to be more safe with his own family than she is. I want to take a quick pause and check in with Alexia, because Alexia, and it, this was important to me, even though I didn't tell you about it, Alexia, it was important to me that we not do this episode without you, because you're the only person in the room today who has even anything close to a similar racial identity as the person who sent us this letter. So it's important to me to check in with you and see what you're thinking and how you're receiving the letter, but also what we've talked about so far.
Yeah, first of all, I appreciate that. Thank you for that insight and purview over the situation. But yeah, I relate to it a lot as a Black woman who is trying to forge important relationships in my life and like not necessarily knowing like what my white friends' backgrounds are and like the conversations that they have when I'm not in the room. So I think it's really important. I do feel as though like when it comes time to have those discussions about like what does this really mean and do you stand for me, like I do feel like a lot of times it falls on me because I, for some reason I have to carry that burden of having those really tough conversations and bringing people to the light, which is something that we talk about a lot as it relates to minorities and their burnout of like having to explain things to white people over and over again. And I'm also thinking about a previous episode that we did at least over a month ago when we talked about it was another relationship question, and I told you that I couldn't date someone who didn't share the same politics as me because my identity is political. And I think that that's a privilege I don't have that white people
white people do have
that they don't think about. So I definitely get where this woman is coming from. And I think every point that you've made is valid so far.
Thanks for weighing in. And thanks for sharing that. Indeed, that is your experience, that you feel like you have to be the one to sort of bring people to the light. That sucks. And also, I'm glad that you like reinforced that, you know, and I'm interested. So I'm interested to hear Huma's ideas about how that dynamic can be overcome in this relationship. But also, Alexia, I'm really interested to hear your ideas about like what you would want, you know, in that situation. So, yeah, I think both of those things are so important. Thank you for sharing, Alexia.
Yeah, of course.
So, yeah, Huma, so now that you've sort of explained to us this dynamic that, that you're observing, how do we overcome that? And how do you think that this person could make that shift to we, but also not feel, is it even an option for her to not feel so burdened by that, given that she is in an interracial relationship? What would she have to do? What would her partner have to do so that she didn't feel that way?
So before we get into kind of the solution for what she should do, I think it's important to understand why in a relationship, taking on that responsibility unwillingly, of course, nobody wants to take the responsibility on themselves willingly. Unwillingly in that relationship, when you find yourself taking that responsibility, the reason why it can be sort of detrimental to the relationship is because it's almost like you're self-silencing against the microaggressions that you're receiving from his family.
Okay.
And what research shows is that
when racial minorities are self-silencing because of fear of a reaction, it might not be an option that they have. It might be a situation that they find themselves in where they feel like our writer here says, you know, I just, out of respect for his family, I have to stay, you know, not engage in the conversation. So with self-silencing comes a lot of sense of alienation. Mm-hmm. And how that happens in relationships is kind of this frustration and anger that builds up towards your partner for not acting and not saying anything.
Mm.
And oftentimes, because anger is a secondary emotion that we're comfortable with showing, and it doesn't take a lot of vulnerability to show anger, we are very comfortable with showing the anger. But when our partner is only on the receiving end of criticisms and anger, Sue Johnson talks about, Sue Johnson is a person who's developed emotionally focused couples therapy. So what she talks about is that when your partner is seeing this anger and this criticism from you, it can create, couples can often find themselves in a negative cycle, which contains one person showing anger and criticism and the other person feeling either shame or guilt or a sense of inadequacy.
Right.
But because they're in the situation where they're not feeling safe in the relationship to show vulnerability either, they might go into shutdown. So if we go back to the writer, if she is feeling really angry about the situation and she even finds the courage to have this difficult conversation with her partner, and she starts to discuss this and becomes angry, which is an absolutely natural response to microaggressions.
Right.
Because it is her partner's family, he might in turn feel the guilt and shame for the actions that they're doing, and also feel inadequacy for not being able to stand up to his family. And then might go into a shutdown.
Okay.
And might want to withdraw from the conversation.
Okay.
Right? When he does that, it further fuels her anger. And the reason why it fuels her anger and feelings of alienation from him is because she feels like he doesn't care. He cares about his family more than he cares about me.
Right,
because
he's shutting down, which is appears very similar to not caring.
And even if in that situation he says, you know, okay, fine. Like, I know they're racist. What do you want me to do about it? That is another way of shutting down, because you're not really open to receiving that feedback of what he should do about it. It is an escalated argument about it, which is not going to lead to a situation where either parties feel safe enough to share what they're really feeling.
Right. So you said that this was like a known cycle. Can you simplify? Can you tell us in like the most simple terms what this cycle is that you're describing? So it goes like this and then this and then.
So there's two sides of the cycle. One is the side which is called the pursuer. Okay. And the other side is called the withdrawer.
Okay.
So whenever we notice relationship issues, it's not because one person is doing something wrong, but because two people are coming together to co-create a negative cycle that is creating more distance in the relationship rather than closeness.
Got it.
So what the pursuer does is, pursuer feels really frustrated or angry with the situations at hand, or feels really alone and in their feelings of hurt and feelings of feeling alone and not cared for or neglected, their emotions get escalated to a point where they want to have a conversation, they want to express these emotions,
right?
But because they're not feeling connected with their partner, they might show anger, they might show criticism.
Sure.
So all the other partner hears is anger and criticism.
Right.
And when you imagine any interaction between two people, when somebody is angry at you or criticizing you, it's going to make you want to withdraw or fight back. Right. So what the withdrawer does is they want to shut down the conversation. They want to withdraw. They might storm out of the room. They might say, all right, then let's just end this, you know? Right. All of these threats or all of these actions that are like, I don't want to have this conversation.
Right.
And that then further fuels the frustration of the other partner. And then this cycle ends up creating more and more distance, where you're not really talking about the issues at hand. You're not expressing how hurt and alone and neglected you feel the other person is not sharing how they're carrying a sense of shame and inadequacy for not meeting the partner's needs.
Right.
Well, when all this time, what both of them want to do is to feel loved and feel acknowledged and feel close to their partner.
So the dynamic that you think might be happening is that the woman who wrote us the letter may be expressing her anger and her frustration, but only to her partner, sort of in private. Mm-hmm. And that when she expresses that, her partner may be withdrawing, which only causes her to feel more angry and more isolated.
Right.
Got it.
And I think a visual with interracial couples that I like to use is kind of imagining this external force or this external interaction that you had with either family or the outside society. And that issue, if you have this visual of like a three-seater couch, so one partner is sitting on one side and the other partner is sitting on the other side. And the mistake that interracial couples usually make is that this thing that happened outside in the world, they see it as sitting between them on the couch, making them feel more distant. What the change needs to happen is them sitting on a love seat right next to each other, where there's no space for anybody else between them. And they're facing this issue head on, which is maybe sitting on a single-seater armchair across from them.
Right, facing it together.
So the biggest shift that I think needs to happen for our writer here is to see this issue as a V issue. This is something that they both need to figure out a solution to. So the shift needs to happen from the I to the we.
Right.
And the only way that the shift can happen from the I to the we is if both partners are able to engage in a conversation about how this makes both partners feel, curiosity about each other's experience of this.
And how do you overcome this dynamic of anger and withdrawal? And what do you think is can be expected of the partner whose family is expressing these racist views that are causing his partner to feel angry and isolated?
So what I would be really curious about in working with, you know, our writer and just sort of reflecting on what she's written is, what is her partner's experience with this? How does he feel in the moment where his dad is asking this question of this person that he absolutely loves?
Right.
What is his experience of noticing that his partner is feeling uncomfortable with his family and is going through these uncomfortable experiences? And what happens for him when she brings it up? What stops him from being able to say that, this situation absolutely sucks and I feel ashamed or I feel so guilty that you have to go through this because of me? And I love you and I hate that the person I love the most is going through the experience because of me. And what can I do to support you in that situation? Let's figure this out together. Right? And my guess is that her partner doesn't feel safe to share that, because when he sees his partner feeling so distraught over this, or if she doesn't feel comfortable having a conversation about it and she goes into a shutdown, then he might feel like there's nothing that he can say that's going to make it better for her. And that's like a state of helplessness that people can find themselves in. So he might not, in that sense of helplessness, might feel like there's nothing that he can do to make the situation better for her.
So part of what you're suggesting is that they maybe they need to hire a therapist so that they can have these conversations, right? But it sounds like what you're getting at is that we and she would need to have a better understanding of what is her partner thinking. Why isn't he taking more of a strong stance? Why is he behaving in ways that are causing her to feel isolated? And you know, if that is talked about and put out in the open and a space is created where there can be a dialogue around that, can that shift such that she can feel more safe and supported And probably that will mean her partner taking a stronger stance with his family.
Yes.
Right? And doing things to clearly demonstrate his support of her and his rebuke of racism.
Right.
But it sounds like what you're saying now is it seems like her partner is just shutting down. And so before we get there, we have to get the partner out of shutdown mode.
Right. So one of the ways that, you know, what happens with couples when they're feeling alienated is the only reality is their pain,
mm-hmm.
and not their partner's pain. And we can feel so engulfed in our own pain that we lose curiosity about our partner's pain. And in this situation, definitely, the writer being a minority surrounded by white Caucasian family and feeling really silenced in that situation, she is suffering from more pain in this situation, absolutely. Right. But there is some level of pain that her partner is going through in terms of feeling like he now has to create maybe boundaries with his family that he didn't have to before.
Right.
So sometimes with interracial couples, what happens is, you know, the person you are in a relationship with might have evolved into a very different person from who their family is. And right. Kudos to them for doing
hopefully.
That.
Hopefully. In this situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it sounds like her partner has evolved in a very different way and created a wonderful identity for himself where he is encouraging of minorities and in a relationship with her and right. loves her for her diversity and for everything that she brings to the table and the person that she is. And that's wonderful.
Right.
But
maybe he's not as woke as he needs to be.
Right? Right. Right. I mean, and maybe he's less comfortable being that part of himself around other white Caucasian people.
Right.
So one thing that happens.
That sounds problematic.
Absolutely problematic. So one
Alexia, feel free to jump in here at any time, by the way.
Yeah. This is really good.
So one of the things that researchers have studied is white racial identity development. Mm-hmm. And one of the concepts that they talk about is how the racial identity of a white person goes from this naive phase of being a white child, not being able to see any color and race, to right. this part of to these interactions with minorities in the world where they can no longer deny
mm-hmm.
that there is racism.
Right.
So they go from the stage of conformity and knowing and thinking that white race is superior and white reality is the only reality and mm-hmm. there is no racism to the space where they're in a dissonance and they can no longer deny it.
Right.
And what happens after that is a lot of people are able to create a white identity that where they feel like they are no longer participating in racism. They are not promoting racism. They are open to minorities. They are just and equitable. But they might then alienate themselves and start hating other white people. Right? That could be one stage. The other stage could be a very compartmentalized identity.
Right.
Where you are very open to minorities and diversity when you're interacting with them, but then in compartmentalizing that and not feeling comfortable to say that in front of your white Caucasian friends who right. might still be racist.
Totally. I mean, I think one of the, as a white person, I just think that any white person, and frankly, like, depending on how we define it, but like, most people in general, if they say that they're not racist, that they're not racist at all, then they are just mistaken. they are unaware.
Ignorant, yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. I do see a lot of liberal white people who are, you know, to go to white fragility, right? White fragility, really uncomfortable mm-hmm. With accepting that there are pieces of them that are also racist.
Absolutely.
Right? There's something that I wanted to add on to what you were saying, Huma, about, you know, healing this dynamic of anger and then the other partner withdrawing, and you know that the Caucasian partner we need to find a space where this dynamic can be discussed, and therefore action can be taken to allow for the person who wrote us the letter to feel safe. Something that stood out to me when I read this letter is a piece of research by John Gottman, who, for those who have been listening, is my favorite relationship researcher. And he wrote something in his book that when I read it, it really stuck out to me because it was so definitive and, for me, so unexpected that something like this would be so definitive. But what he writes in his book, and keep in mind, John Gottman is a researcher and not a therapist, and he translates his work into therapy. But what he's looking at first and foremost is, what does the research prove is necessary, right? And so what he writes in his book is that if you want your relationship to thrive, if ever there comes a moment where you have to choose between taking the side of your partner or taking the side of your family of origin, you must choose your partner. Mm-hmm. And you must show to your family that you are siding with your partner, essentially against them. And he says, you must do this even if you think that your partner is in the wrong, right? And you have to do that in order to not isolate your partner and make your partner feel that it's you and your family against them, that you love your family more than you love them, but also to send a clear message to your family that this is your new family. And that they need to fall in line and respect your partner. Mm-hmm, that absolutely. Is like the stick that you have to put in the ground. And he goes on to say that if there is some kind of conflict between your family and your partner, and let's say you even think that your partner is in the wrong, in front of your family, you have to say, I'm sorry, family, but I'm with my partner on this. You know, I don't agree with you. My partner and I stand together. Mm-hmm. And then later in private, that's when you can tell your partner, actually, you know, I really don't agree with you on this, but, you know, it's important to me that I take your side in the situation of you and my family disagree on something. So that always stood out to me from the research. And that's not even about interracial couples, but I think it applies very much in this situation whereby the partner has to understand that it is his duty and responsibility to take the side of his woman, right? To take the side of his partner and to make a clear indication of that to his family in order that his relationship can thrive, mm-hmm. right? And that his family understands that this is his new family unit, and that he is going to prioritize that new family unit in a way that's superior to how he has prioritized his family of origin. Mm-hmm. So that is what the research says. And I think that that's important for a person in any partnership to know, but particularly in a situation like this.
Right. And it can be something as simple as the partner saying, when, you know, the parent is coming up and saying, asking a question of the woman that is uncomfortable for her, her partner taking a clue and saying, you know, Dad, it's interesting you asked that because we were talking about this the other day, and we feel like this issue of, right. you know, whatever the issue is at hand, right? This issue of racism is absolutely like not on, and this needs to change, and voicing their views as a united front.
Right. So her partner taking responsibility when the issue comes up to say, actually, you know, right away, before anything has an opportunity to occur, actually, we've talked about this. Dad, this is what I need you to know.
Right. And presenting that united front.
Absolutely. And being the one, even beyond, to me, the united front, being the one to say, I am with my partner on this, and I'm not with you.
And empowering her.
Absolutely.
To then be able to add on with her opinions.
Right. So we have to wrap up. I think we need to do another episode
on this. Absolutely.
So
we'll be up for that.
Coming soon. There's so much to say. I think that, and I hope that this issue is relevant to many people, and that it's something that we can continue to talk about, because I think that talking about the relationships, whether it's romantic or not, between people of different races is, to me, one of the pathways towards healing and towards better thriving in our society. So thank you, Huma, for being here.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Alexia, for, as always,
thank you guys.
For being you in the world. Thank you all for listening. And as always, have a miraculous day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.